Mr. Martin and Ms. Campbell. I will get this right. Mr. Martin, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Check your reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes, please.
All right.
And if it pleases the court, Your Honor, Mr. Norman is before the court on plea for consideration of this case. As the court notes, having reviewed the facts of this case, appellant argues that the evidence was not sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the essential elements of abduction were met by the Commonwealth at trial. As Your Honors are aware, abduction requires an execution of force, intimidation, or deception on the part.
Is there any reason why the trial court was required to accept the testimony of the quote-unquote victim as opposed to her sister? I mean, why couldn't the court piece together an account and largely credit the sister's testimony over the victim's testimony or whatever?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the court obviously can look at the evidence as presented by the sister, that her testimony, her observations of the events on September 28, 2013 in Ms. Wilson's home. But that testimony was limited. There was an observation on the part of Ms. Natasha Wilson, the sister, of seeing her sister, the alleged victim, in the bedroom, hearing arguments, but nothing more than that, Your Honor. There was evidence that she observed the alleged victim walk down the stairs.
Well, I mean, if I'm in bed and locked doors are kicked in.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, that's intimidating in a very commonsensical sort of way. I mean, he didn't knock, was admitted, there's a discussion.
I think it is telling, Your Honor, that the alleged victim was asleep. She did not necessarily know that the doors were knocked in. Her testimony was that in terms of whether or not later on in speaking with the police, whether she should take out a protective order, she indicated to the police, I did not know that the doors were knocked in. And on direct...
Her sister did.
Her sister did.
She certainly knew the door was knocked into her bedroom because that's what woke her up.
But specifically, the intimidation would have to be the alleged victims. She was not aware that the doors were knocked in and was not aware at the time when she spoke with the police officer and actually indicated that had she heard appellant knock at the door, had she not been drunk and asleep, that she would have opened the door for him. She repeatedly, throughout trial, indicated that she was not afraid of the appellant, that she felt safe at all times.
In trial courts, in some of these domestic cases, you know, the victim initially under the shock of what happened will say one thing, and then months go by before trial, and then there's a change of heart for a variety of reasons. Maybe the defendant's repented, maybe she's economically dependent on him or whatever. And so there's this change of heart. And so just because the person in this domestic relationship provides one account doesn't mean the court has to credit it if other facts support the fact that a crime has occurred.
Yes, Your Honor. And that would bring us back to the only other person that testified being the sister to your earlier question. And again, she observed nothing in terms of an assault. The alleged victim said she was not assaulted.
No, we're talking about abduction, though. Correct.
But in terms of what that other witness may have observed to substantiate that abduction.
What about this thump or crashing sound or whatever? What do we make of that?
That would obviously depend on who heard that. The alleged victim did not hear that.
That's right. But the sister, or she said she didn't, but the sister said she did.
Yes.
She actually said she heard a smack.
Smack, right.
She said she heard a smack, Your Honor, but did not assign it to any one particular individual.
But wouldn't a reasonable inference be that she heard it coming from upstairs right after he busted into the room?
She did hear it from upstairs. I think that was the evidence, Your Honor. But the alleged victim said she was not hit. She was not assaulted.
So you're saying that rebuts the reasonable inference?
Yes, because she was the only one in the room, Your Honor, that could testify with any clarity about what was the cause of that sound.
But that's up to the trier of fact.
It is. There's an inference there to be made, Your Honor. But when the alleged victim consistently, precisely testifies throughout trial that I was not assaulted, I was never afraid, I was not intimidated, I was never bound to my house, nor was I forced to leave the house.
Well, let me interrupt you. As I understand your brief, your argument on
yes,
brief at least, is you're focusing us on two elements of the abduction statute, the use of whether or not the evidence was sufficient to show force, threat, or intimidation,
yes,
and also the degree of either aspiration of the victim by the use of force or detention of the victim by the use of force.
Yes,
correct.
Right.
Now, so, I mean, it all comes down to whether or not there's evidence of force, threat, or intimidation. Judge McCullough made the point earlier that the trial court here made it an express credibility determination and concluded that the sister was the basis, essentially, the sister's testimony was the basis for the verdict in this case, as opposed to the victim's testimony, who to some degree recanted, I guess. Now, focusing on that, it seems to me, if we're looking at a standard of review based on sufficiency, the evidence of the light most favorable to the Commonwealth from the sister's testimony is that these doors were in fact kicked in. That would certainly be a use of force. And that the victim in this case was crying. He walked her down the stairs with his head on the back of her head, took her outside, and arguably, I guess, at least detained her outside for some period of time until the police arrived. And then and the sister also testified that the victim appeared to be frightened, very frightened and distraught. So if that's the evidence that the trial court considered, explain to us why that would be insufficient, irrespective of what the victim testified to here. Why
yes,
would
sir.
That be sufficient?
Just one point of clarification. There was no recantation. There were no prior statements. I think that
that was a poor choice
change
of words
of heart,
on my part. I think that was a bad choice of words on my part. My apologies.
And as far as the use of force with the doors, Your Honor, that would speak to the breaking and entering. But it would not speak to the intent to force someone by way of intimidation or physical force and to detain them, to deprive them of their liberty. So it would not speak to the actual
You don't think
it
would be intimidating, just a common sense, it would be intimidating if somebody kicked in your front door and made an appearance in your bedroom all of a sudden?
It would be intimidating if not for the testimony of that complaining witness.
But that wasn't credited.
Excuse me, sir?
It wasn't credited by the fact finder.
It was not. I'm not.
The fact finder didn't assign a lot of weight to that evidence. I'll put it that way.
Disbelieved it.
Right.
Yeah.
And only relied on the testimony of the sister. Again, the only thing that she observed was or heard was the crashing, and observed her sister, who was not afraid. She said she was crying. That was easily explained by the fact that she was upset by being awakened in her drunken state. And she wanted to prevent further argument with that sister, which is the reason she left the house in the first place. Her direct statement was, I was trying to defuse any argument between the appellant and my sister.
As my colleague Judge Decker likes to point out, that's a great jury argument you just made. But it's, you know, we're not a jury. The question is there evidence in the record that, in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, supports the elements of the offense? And I guess, you know, given where the trial court put its I think you'd have to convince us that the sister's testimony doesn't establish any of these elements, or at least not enough of these elements.
I would argue that it does not establish force. There was no observation of force on the part of the sister. She did indicate as the parties moved down the stairs, she recalled the hand of the appellant being on the head or on the person of the alleged victim in this matter.
You're saying as a matter of law that does not rise to the level of force? Is that your argument?
It would be my argument, given, again, the statements of the victim, who indicated, I don't even remember his hand on me, and if it was on my shoulder.
Okay, but you have to discount the victim's testimony. We have to, at this juncture, we have to rely on what the trial court found credible.
Yes, sir.
So your position is that, assuming the sister's testimony, that the piece that's insufficient is the element of force.
Yes.
Is that?
Yes, and I would argue that the hand to the head, and with no further information, would not be sufficient at law. Nor would there be intimidation. Simply crying would not substantiate intimidation, Your Honor.
What about frightened?
Frightened, Your Honor, frightened would be an impression on the part of that one witness.
Well, it's an observation. She said she testified that my sister appeared to be very frightened and distraught.
She appeared to be frightened and distraught. She appeared to be frightened because she was awakened at that hour of the night. She was still in an intoxicated state.
Well, that's your explanation, but it's not one that the fact finder necessarily accepted.
Yes, it was the victim's explanation, Your Honor. So what I think we have here, Your Honor, is can inferences be made? Yes. Are those inferences reasonable given the totality of what the trier of fact heard? And what the trier of fact heard was that there was nothing more than a verbal argument between these parties. An alleged victim who did not want the police called. She clearly indicated that to her sister, do not call the police. We want to talk this out. I just want him out of the house so that you two don't argue any further. And so for the court to infer and rise above the level of that evidence to convict my client of an abduction, an intentional offense that is dependent upon the subjective interpretation of the alleged victim, who has indicated that clearly I was not intimidated, I was not forced, I was not detained against my will, and solely rely on the testimony of this sister of the victim, who was not in the position.
But is that so? I mean, you have the indisputably the doors were kicked in. I mean, there's the photos, and that's not really challenged. And you also had the police officer who encounters the couple as they're walking in the neighborhood,
yes.
And the victim is again weeping and is in a frightened state. Now, of course, you have the victim's explanation that it was because of the way I woke up and the way I was drinking. That's why I was crying. But so. Maybe it's just a minor point, but I don't think the exclusive evidence before the court of intimidation arose solely out of the Natasha's testimony. There were also surrounding circumstances that the court could look to.
There were circumstances that the court could look to, but I believe that they were negated by the statements of the alleged victim. What I think we have here, in some sense, is an inference that we knew what was going on that night, even though the evidence does not substantiate it. And I think that that's where the trier of fact fell, that we have a big picture here, we know what's going on. But when we are limited to the testimony under oath of the alleged victim, and she's saying it did not happen, and there is no prior inconsistent statement, then the court must rely on those words and not rise above that evidence.
All right, thank you. Ms. Campbell, we're glad to hear from Commonwealth.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on the behalf of the Commonwealth. The defendant is challenging the sufficiency of the evidence for the abduction charge, and this Court is well aware of the standard of review for sufficiency and has already pointed out something I think that needs reiteration is that when faced with a record that can have conflicting inferences, the appellate court presumes that the trier of fact solved those inferences in favor of the prosecution. And not only that, but here on the record, the trial court did explain the inferences and which testimony he was crediting more so than the other, all in favor of the Commonwealth. So in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the facts are based on the sister's testimony more than the victim's. And in this case, based on the facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth and the reasonable inferences from those facts, it's clear that the defendant intended, through the use of force and intimidation, intended to deprive the victim of her personal liberty.
And what's the evidence of force, counsel?
The evidence of force doesn't have to be an assault, as I think the defendant is trying to claim. The evidence of force can be very slight. And in this case, we have, and the trial court noted, there was definitely some sort of altercation occurred in that bedroom. whether he hit her, whether there was just screaming at each other. Something happened in the bedroom, and then he led her down the stairs. There's no case law that says she needs to be resisting.
Well, let me interrupt you and follow up on Judge Decker's question. Here, she seems to me the force, to the extent it's in the record in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, is her going down the stairs with him pulling the back of her head. And then I think the evidence from when the police officer arrived, he's with her outside and in a manner that suggests she's may or may not be free to leave at that point. If that's as good as it gets for the Commonwealth, and then I guess the question would be the use of force, while there's case law, and I think it's our Clanton case, there are Armand Clanton case that says that the use of force can be slight, but it has to be enough under the totality of the circumstances to overbear the will of the victim. And I guess my question would be, how do we get to that, since to get to the evidence that it was enough to overbear the will of the victim based solely on the sister's testimony?
Sure, of course, Your Honor. Based on the totality of circumstances, answering this sort of two-part, one is the force and or intimidation. And I think when you take the totality of the circumstances, what you have is a defendant who breaks in the middle of the night after leaving from a previous altercation, comes back unexpected in the middle of the night, and breaks into the home. Goes upstairs.
With violence, I mean, not picking the lock.
Right.
He's kicking in two locked doors.
Yes, Your Honor. Kicked in the two locked doors, made a lot of noise, woke the entire household up, the other people that were living there, and went upstairs and woke her up. He then, and her testimony is, and along with the sisters, is that they had been drinking. They were intoxicated, and this is also what contributed to her to being upset. And that's why the victim claims she was so upset. And I think the Commonwealth's position is also that just because the defendant took advantage of this situation by breaking into the house in the middle of the night when she's sleeping and removing her from her bed, that is force. And just because she wasn't able to resist, either because she was incredibly intimidated by his behavior and how he'd been acting previously in the night and at that moment in time, it doesn't mean that his behavior is lawful because she is not exerting a lot of force in resisting him.
But do you even need force? I mean, the statute provides alternatives, deception being one, where no force is used. And if someone shows up with a gun and never lays a finger on the person, says, get out of the house and into the car, that's intimidation, and isn't that enough under the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, I would completely agree, and I think the Commonwealth here has both force and intimidation based on the totality of the circumstances of the defendant's behavior.
Slight force, but a lot of intimidation is what it boils down to, I guess, from your perspective.
Yes, I think that, based on the record, that could be the interpretation. His behavior was clearly intimidating to her. I think it's incredibly noteworthy, as the trial court pointed out, that afterwards she went and got a protective order against him. And she wouldn't have done that if this was a consensual encounter that she wanted to engage in. Once he was removed from her, she wanted to go get a protective order. Like, she wanted to do something about this. And I think that goes to the use of force or intimidation. And there was talk when the defendant was arguing about how there was no previous statement. But she did acknowledge on page 50 of the appendix that she told the police officers that she didn't want to go with him and that she was upset and mad at the time. And I think that shows that she told police officers that she didn't want to go with him when she was alone and not with him. So when he was removed from the scene, her position was that she had not wanted to go with him. So she was, at that time, she was intimidated by him. And now that she's backtracking from that, I think that doesn't go to what was actually happening there. She admits she was very upset and mad, and that's because she was...
Well, does that go to credibility or an impeachment, or is that admitted for its substance, the prior statement?
Your Honor, I think it probably goes more towards impeachment. And
I mean, I can't think of, and maybe, you know, just in the moment, I don't know of a hearsay exception that would let it come in. But anyway.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, it was a statement. She was asked what she had told, and she said it, and it wasn't objected to, and I think the trial court could rely on it based on that. But again, and I think the defendant's intent was clearly demonstrated that he intended to deprive her of her liberty. He, as I've already stated, he broke in, but based on the time of night, he was trying to be deceptive when he was knocking and this victim's sister was trying to see who was outside and what was going on. He led her in some sort of physical capacity down the stairs and outside, and as the court noted, still had his arm around her when they were outside walking around. His actions clearly showed his intent to deprive her of her physical liberty and that he used the force or intimidation to do so. The trial court's findings are not plainly wrong or without evidence to support them. The trial court was in the best position to listen to these witnesses and decide based on their intonation who was more credible and weigh the evidence. And if the court does not have any further questions, we would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you. All right, thank you, Ms. Campbell. Mr. Martin?
Thanks. Your Honor, just a few points of clarification. I think it's important to note that the alleged victim in this matter, according to the testimony at trial, was not forced out of her bed. She voluntarily got out of bed. She put her pants on prior to leaving the bedroom and proceeding down the stairs. And I would just reiterate, Your Honors, that by analogy, if an individual is assaulted, there's an allegation of assault, it is incumbent upon the Commonwealth to show that that alleged victim was in effect insulted by a touching, whether that touching was unwanted. And I think it, by civil argument with an abduction, when you have an individual who is saying, I was not forced, I was not intimidated, I was not deprived of my liberty, despite what it may have appeared to others, I was not, I did not have.
Well, it's certainly in the abstract, it seems to me, if I were to observe two people engaged in an assault,
yes, sir,
and then the for whatever reason, the victim chose to say it never happened, and I were called as a witness and testified under oath that it did happen as to what I observed, are you suggesting that wouldn't be enough to convict the anyone of assault?
It would be a matter of nuance, Your Honor, because if someone were to pat someone's back and Your Honor observed that, how would you interpret that? How would any trier of fact interpret that? You would go to the person whose back was touched and say, was that a friendly gesture or was that a point of harm to you? Were you insulted by that touching? And if that individual says, I was not insulted by that, he's a good friend, he was just patting me on the back, it's kind of hard, but he does pat me on the back pretty hard, that, in effect, would not be an assault, Your Honor. And by similar comparison, when you have a victim here who's saying, hey, we yell a lot. We don't get along necessarily. We have verbal arguments. Another person observing that may not know what was going on in the mind of that particular individual.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank
We're going to come down and recounsel and take up the last case of the day, which is...